You're listening to Random Idiocy, candid conversations about geek culture. Welcome back, everybody. In this episode, I'm joined by writer James Nennis. How are you doing, James?
Good. How's it going?
Good, good. Also with writer Fred Vanlente. How are you, sir?
Very well. How are you?
Very good. And I would say writer, but you're also an artist, so I guess I'll call you creator, Phil Hester?
Yes. Phil Hester, the creator.
The creator. The legendary Phil Hester, if I saw on Twitter, correct?
Yes. It's like Cedric the Entertainer.
Oh, there you go.
Multi-threat Phil Hester.
Exactly. So, well, I'd say the first time I, found out who Phil was through the his Green Arrow work. I didn't know he was a writer first. Or were you a writer first or an artist first?
I was an artist first. I mean, as far as everybody knows. I mean, like everybody who starts out in comics, you do everything. You know, you write, draw, letter. Mm-hmm. But I think I started playing my trade first as a penciler.
Oh, right on. Cool. Very cool. All right, guys. Hopefully you guys have looked over the preset topic, so we can just dive right into the shenanigans, as it were.
I disagree.
Hold on. You got to save that after Phil speaks. That's when you say
it. Damn it. Sorry.
It's all right. I'll edit it. It'll be fine. It's fine. You're a little nervous. It's okay. All right. Well, since we're on the internet, the first thing I think about with the internet is porn. So we have a site called come4.org. It's trying to become the first nonprofit porn site, and their whole.
You should spell that out for everybody. I think you should spell actual.
Well, because they actually spell it. They spell it the non-sexy way, which I'm surprised. It's C-O-M-E, the number 4.org. They're raising funds to start their website, and their whole thing is, instead of taking the money from themselves for the advertising and you pay for subscriptions, they're actually going to take that money, and you can decide what charity your money goes to. And I'm like, wow, I've never thought of porn and charity put together, but I mean, I guess that's a good thing, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, I don't know. I guess if you're going to watch porn online, you might as well do it for charity. I mean, it makes you feel better about it.
I guess if there's guilt there to assuage, that might be the way to go. Mm. But, maybe indulging in guilty pleasures is the whole point. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I would feel kind of weird knowing that while if you're watching some dirty, filthy thing that, your money is helping a poor puppy in a shelter, I guess. It's a weird association.
Well, what's the charity? That's what I would want to know. I mean, is it something...
No, you get to choose.
So
if you're big about animals, you can donate all your money to the ASPCA. If you want to do starving kids in Ethiopia, you could do that. So every time you click to download Two Girls in a Cup, they get like 25 cents or something. I don't know. However, whatever the rates will be.
I guess I don't understand, why not beat off to porn and give money to charity? Like, I don't quite see the connection between, it almost sounds like a weird way to either get you to view less porn or to give less money to charity. I don't quite follow the logic here. It almost sounds like there are those sites that set up, that you can set up, and they're advertising them among writers a lot, where you actually can set up an account where you get penalized for, monetarily fined for wasting too much time on Twitter and Facebook and so forth.
Really? I've never heard of that.
Yeah. I can't remember what the hell it's called, but, or where I heard about it. Maybe I dreamt it. I don't think so. But, it almost sounds like that. Yeah, it sounds like a worthy goal to combine porn with, it just seems inefficient to me. The Dutch part of me doesn't quite get it,
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be there. People are going to – that's what the internet is sadly mostly used for probably. And if they could raise a few bucks, I guess it's somewhat honorable.
Well, I guess it's used for porn and extracting money from people, So this kind of combines its two major functions into one.
And you could also target – you could cut out the middleman and give to a meth rehab charity.
Right. I was thinking teenage runaways. What would be the most porn appropriate,
Yeah.
Charity.
I don't know. I've never done the
Planned Parenthood. I don't know what's the charity.
There you go. Planned Parenthood, like you said, teen runaways. I guess that would be, if you're going for word association, porn to charity, that'd be the first one that come to my head.
How does this work? Maybe I'm not understanding. Is it like every click you're giving five, like they're going to give 5 cents to a charity, or are you?
Yeah, well, how does like any website when you have like ads on your page, and that's how they generate revenue by people clicking on the ads?
So you have to watch porn and click an ad.
Well, are like a prescription, the prescription subscription to a site, like people pay for, you know, premium access to different things, like for any site, really. If you go to music sites, movie sites, to a porn site, you pay a few bucks more a month, you get, you know, you get to watch your movie without an ad, you get a HD version or whatever. That subscription cost, once they cover their cost for their servers or whatever, the rest of it is going, they're going to let you donate to charity.
This feels weirder to me than just the idea of looking at porn for some reason. I'm actually less comfortable looking at charity porn than I would be looking at normal porn.
Hey,
I'm not sure I'm
into
that.
And you're paying for porn.
Yeah, this is not going to decrease my guilt. This is going to increase my guilt.
Like, yeah, you'll feel obligated.
Yeah, well, what like, do you have to click a picture of, like, for this session, I'm going to give to this starving child, and then I'm going to look at porn? Because
really
there's something
wanna,
weird about that.
Do I really want to be thinking about fighting testicular cancer while
right.
I'm touching my dick?
Yes.
Know, that seems like two urges that going there simultaneously that are going to collide uncomfortably.
Well, I mean, the way I look at it, it's like the net that saves you. Like if you're at home and your significant other walks in and you're watching porn, oh, baby, no, I'm doing this for the children.
Yeah, that won't work on
no,
that.
No.
That's the line you use. I don't think you say I'm doing this for the children.
No, that wouldn't help.
No, is that worse?
That's
no,
yeah.
I don't know if it'd be worse, but it would not be good.
Well, I mean, it's charity. I mean, I guess if you're going to watch porn, at least give back to society, I guess is what they're going for.
I can think
it really,
of ways to give to
so
charity.
It really is.
Better
this,
things
is
to
like,
do with my porn.
This is like a charity for Catholics, for people who feel bad about being literally what this is. This is monetizing sex guilt, which I should say I don't have a problem with, you know. Fetish specialists have been doing that for years. So why not PETA? You know, I love it.
There
go for it. If they can separate money from folks, go for it. I'll just write a check.
Exactly. I'll just donate without the porn. No, thanks
right.
for porn.
No, I'll still look at porn. I just won't connect the two.
It creates an odd thought process. So
I'll keep a wall between my charity and my porn.
There's a firewall between porn.
Exactly. Don't. It's you know. It's not peanut butter and chocolate. It doesn't go well together. It's like peanut butter.
No.
And like yeah. No. So.
No.
All right. Also, what we had happen just last week. Was a gentleman fell from space. I mean, it's exaggerating, but basically Felix Baumgartner jumped from 23 miles up. And, I mean, it was like a 40-minute fall. It's just, that just boggles my mind that someone could go that high. It's like, yeah, I want to fall from space. You know, I mean, it happens in comic books all the time. You see Superman and other space heroes can plummet into Earth. Now Felix Baumgartner can say, yeah, I know what Superman was feeling when he was falling to Earth. I mean, he broke the sound barrier as a person. He was going like up to 800 miles an hour, I think, at one point. That's ridiculous.
That's a badass suit he's wearing, too.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. I would normally thought it was kind of stupid and silly until I saw the suit.
Yeah.
And then I thought, no, style points. Mm-hmm. The suit, the little balloon, they all look very cool. NASA could learn a lot from that.
My favorite thing is that apparently this was sponsored by Red Bull.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whose motto is Red Bull gives you wings. Clearly they don't.
Well, maybe he didn't. Well,
because he fell. He just dropped like a rock.
Well, maybe Red Bull gives you wings in normal situations, but not from 23 miles up. You would need to drink like a pallet full of it, and then that would just kill you.
Nah, it also tastes terrible, so I can't. Unless it gives me wings, I'm not particularly interested.
That slogan would have been a lot worse if he didn't make it.
like,
yeah, boom. PR would have been a lot worse if he landed without the parachute.
After you land 23 after 23 miles, then Red Bull gives you wings.
I couldn't imagine. I mean, what's going through your head when you're? I mean, you got to figure he's falling for a good 35, 40 minutes before he pulls a chute or whatever. That's not like a regular skydive where it's like 5 minutes and like, oh, I'm screaming for 5 minutes. Because you can't scream for 45 minutes. You'll go, your voice will just go out. At some point, you actually have to calm down and just, I guess, enjoy the view. I mean, that's a long time just to think about, wow, I really hope this parachute opens. That'd be my thought for the entire 40 minutes. Please open, please open, please open.
I guess if you're an experienced skydiver, you get over that pretty quick.
Yeah, but I don't know. What does it say that Red Bull is putting people almost into space? I mean, that the United we don't really have a good space thing here in America anymore. But Red Bull, they're putting people almost into space. Makes you wish NASA would like a Kickstarter or something.
I'm not sure. Like James Cameron and the asteroids, man. Isn't he's getting ready to mine asteroids and space is going private.
Yeah. Well, the Virgin Atlantic guy, he's starting to raise funds to send people to Mars. I guess that's his new thing he's focusing on.
Well, I mean, NASA dropped a SUV from orbit, basically. They did basically the same thing, but on Mars and with a giant robot. So, yeah. Still fairly impressive, if not more impressive.
I would say hitting Mars from Earth with an SUV is way more impressive than just coming from space.
I mean, Red Bull.
Yeah, exactly. Touche.
We don't need you.
So, but I don't know. Would that be something you guys, I mean, have you ever guys thought about skydiving in general? I mean, that's something I've always wanted to try, but I'm always afraid to be the guy whose parachute doesn't open.
No, I can't.
No way, man.
Yeah, I've met too many skydivers.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
I met too many of the people that pack the chutes.
Usually at a bar.
Yeah, I'm not totally 100% behind your police work there.
Yeah, that's kind of like in high school where you stop eating at a restaurant once your friend gets a job in the kitchen because you don't trust your friend to make food. So why would you eat there?
Yeah, Golden Corral left my stable. Like that was the first restaurant out of my rotation. Mm. I had friends that worked at a Golden Corral.
Oh, that's an East Coast thing. I don't think they have any of those out here in California. I've never seen one.
They got them. They got them. Oh. I've seen them. Yeah. I had a friend work at Taco Bell, and he told me the beans were a powder, and that was the end of that.
That's funny. I assumed it was a West Coast thing because I've never seen one, and but the ads are all over at least cable. I've never seen one in New York.
Sizzler.
Ooh, Sizzler. So, I don't know. I guess the craziest thing I took from Baumgartner falling from space was a. Neil deGrasse Tyson pointed out that if you take a regular-sized school globe to show kids how far he fell from, if you just have to go 1 millimeter up from the globe, and that's how high he actually was.
Yeah.
And you think 23,000 miles? Eh, it's only a millimeter, really. I mean, I guess you think about how far away the moon is and Mars is, all that kind of stuff. It's impressive for a human, but in the cosmic scheme of things, it's really not all that.
Jeez, nice buzzkill, Tyson.
I'm just saying, it's impressive, but
that's
Tyson's got to ruin everything.
First Pluto, now this.
Hey, it's all right. I mean, who really even liked Pluto in the long run? I mean, really. How many kids were sitting there with Pluto's my favorite planet backpack on when you go into school?
I was surprised at the sudden irrational wave of support for Pluto.
Yeah, I mean, I never saw it when I was in high school, but apparently there was a big Pluto club that I never went to because they must have. So.
No. A Pluto club? What would you do?
No, they had it. there was an astrology club that was at my high school. Those are the only people I would think would actually care about Pluto. I mean,
we're here to talk about the Roman god of the underworld, the disputed ninth planet, or Mickey Mouse's dog.
Exactly.
So.
Unless you're not interested in one of those three things, get out.
All right. Next we have is writer George R.R. Martin of the Game of Thrones, which is a book and a TV series I've never watched. And from the Wild Cards series, which are books I've actually read. He was at Worldcon, I guess. He was asked about writing for Marvel, and something he said, if he would write for Marvel, he would want something guaranteed that what he wrote would never be changed. There would be no Superboy punching reality, no Marvel Now to change things. I mean, when I read that and heard about that, I'm like, that's freaking ridiculous. I mean, it's comic books. Everything gets rebooted at some point. Is there a writer or someone good enough to actually come out and say, I want this? Would anybody ever agree to something that crazy?
No, never.
I don't see how.
I think that's George R.R. Martin's way of saying, I would never write for Marvel. I mean, I don't think he was really making a serious... I'm not sure he was doing a job interview there.
Yeah, oh, I agree. I'm just the thought that someone would... I mean, I guess if you wanted to have a world where it would not be rebooted on you, you'd make your own book and go like through Image or something, and then you got your own universe. You don't have to worry about it.
Well, in a way, nothing's ever really rebooted. I mean, the first Amethyst Princess of Gemworld series is still there.
Well, true.
It's never going anywhere.
True.
But unlike in comics, you know, there is a big hullabaloo, you know, when anything that was created by a singular person, you know, gets rebooted, you know, whether it's new James Bond novels or whether it's the Scarlet, the Gone with the Wind sequel, you know. And I you know, to some extent, and I think to somebody like George R.R. Martin, that's the way it should be, you know.
But I think even in that world, you can only expect that to last your lifetime.
Yeah.
And then after you're gone, it's one way or another, it's going to become free game.
Yeah, well, I think what Martin's getting at is that, you know, why, if somebody asks George R.R. Martin if he wants to write for Marvel, the only reason somebody like that would want to write for Marvel would be, you know, if they were publishing something that he created, or if he had some desperate childlike need to do a run on, I don't know, Daredevil or, you know, Hulk or Spider-Man or whatever, some cherished franchise, because there's really no motivation for somebody who, you know, created one of the most popular book series of the last two decades, however long it's been, you know?
You said the magic words. I think desperate childlike need is sort of the prerequisite for this career.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think everyone in comics has wanted to write a comic or draw a comic since they first saw a comic. It's something you don't really hear too often, some guy in his mid-30s or 40s going, you know what, I'm going to go into comics. It doesn't usually happen. So.
Well, it sometimes takes that long to get there. It took me until I was in my 30s.
Well, no, I mean, but how long have you wanted, how long has it been a goal of yours? I mean, it's not like you were working as a, you know, accountant up to your 35th birthday, and then you woke up saying, I want to write, you know, Hercules, and that's what you decided to do the next day.
Well, I didn't need Marvel to write Hercules. It's public domain. But, yeah, well, what's the question? What are you getting at?
Well, no, I'm just saying that what Phil was saying is how people in the comic industry generally have the childlike obsession or need to work on Daredevil or Superman or whatever, because it's something you've always wanted. And I was pointing out that I don't think anyone decides to become a comic writer or artist as a midlife crisis. I don't really ever see that happening.
But I actually think that you're talking about two different things. I mean, I think that, I and Phil, correct me wrong, I think you also would come from this sort of I had a desire to do comics. I didn't necessarily want to write Spider-Man, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was very grateful when I ended up being asked to write Spider-Man, and I enjoyed doing it. It was a dream come true. But I, you know, what I wanted to do was create comics, not, you know. There are some guys, many of them quite famous and successful, in this field, who literally want to write Spider-Man, and God knows what happens to them when they play Spider-Man, because, you know, that's they've achieved their goal. You know, I have a very close friend, somebody that Phil's worked with, that his entire life's goal was to draw Superman, you know?
Yeah.
And he got to do that, but then, you know, then he got to do that. Now he's going on doing his own creator-owned projects, you know what I mean? But I just, I knew him from when he was in the mid-20s, and he literally had that his main desire was literally to draw Superman, because he fell in love with the medium with Christopher Reeve films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just two sort of separate urges, and I guess that, you know, I don't think Martin is coming from, I think Martin's coming from a place of honesty, and I can certainly see why people in comics get deep as being arrogant, but I don't really think it's being arrogant. I think he's laying down a set of principles that he knows the big corporations who own these characters would never follow.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's somebody like him who has the power to dictate his own terms because of his success. It's sort of laying out the difference between what he does and what, you know, most of the Marvel.
That's fair. I mean, that gets to a major conversation. What we're going to have tonight is about the importance of continuity. That seems to be the sacred cow, the holy thing that so many comic fans demand for. That you have like this split where some people are like, don't you dare change my Superman. His underwear is on the outside. He's married to Lois Lane. Then you have other fans who are like, you know what? No, I'm tired of reading about the guy with the shorts on the outside. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, is there a compromise somewhere we can have, or do we actually? Are we ever going to find peace in this war of the fans?
I'm of the mind that it's a self-resolving problem, because I think the only people who buy that continuity is forever are people that are just getting into the hobby, and the only people that are offended by changes are guys that are just readers that are just starting to reach the twilight of that period of their readership, of their fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that's been reading comics for 20 or 30 years knows how cyclical things are and understands that sort of true continuity is almost a meritocracy. Like the things that people yeah. think are hard and fast rules about Batman are all the good things that have happened in Batman.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cream rises, you know. So I think the only people that get offended are, you know, guys or readers that might be, you know, like I said, in the twilight of their first phase of fandom and can't fathom the idea of changing what they came in with. To my mind, and I can pinpoint that in myself, like to my mind, the Contest of Champions, this throwaway miniseries that happened when I was a kid, it's more real than Avengers versus X-Men because it happened at that point in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at this point in my life, I see Avengers versus X-Men as another cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel the same way about Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars.
Right.
Came out right after that. Yeah, I mean, you know, continuity is like variants and events. It's something everyone complains about, but people buy them, you know what I mean? Like, why are there so many events? Well, because they sell better than regular comics. You know, it's like, you know, vote with your dollars, people, if you don't like it, you know. It's funny. The other problem with continuity, of course, is that, you know, and this is sort of a malaise of the big two just in general, is, you know, the problem with American comics has always been that no one is really making a huge effort other than a bunch of plucky self-publishers and creator-owned people to bring in new people in the medium. And the problem with comics is that we're not getting fresh faces with the medium. We're getting the same, you know, people to look at the comics 17, 18, 19, 20 times again. You know what I mean? So that's why you have the DC line reboot. That's why Spider-Man is no longer Peter Parker. There's a new number one, and why you kill off the Human Torch and you do all this stuff to goose the numbers. And people go, you know, the internet lights up with outrage, but the outrage is getting you to talk about the book, and your outrage is what's fueling you buying the book. So as long as you get mad about it, they're going to keep doing it. In other words, it's almost like continuity exists to be violated and to be tweaked. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, I think that, you know, it's very interesting going from, from being at Marvel, where I tended to be on BEC-level books, where it was constantly a struggle to get eyeballs on the titles because the big complaint was, well, they don't matter. You know what I mean? So on a certain level, to me, that's what continuity means. Is that what are the mainline books of the Marvel Universe? You know, I mean, Avengers was a mid-list book until they suddenly said in 2005, nope, now it's the main book. We're putting, you know, one of our best writers on it, and now this is going to be the lead float in the parade. And then immediately, you know, the numbers went up. And that to me, is the function of continuity, not necessarily, you know, the clusterfuck that's like the Visions, you know, origin, or how many years has Bruce Wayne been Batman? Apparently 220, probably the Avengers he's gone on between now and 1939, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Slight side note, I worked at a movie studio where one of my producers, I was talking to him one day, we were making comics, and he goes, well, I can't remember what got us on this, but he had this website where he charted out Batman's timeline or Batman's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, like, you know, like this year that happened. And he said, well, sort of, but not really. And I didn't quite understood what he meant until I went to the website, and the guy literally took every published Batman appearance.
Oh, shit.
Attempted to put it into the life, minute to minute, day to day, hour to hour, of a guy who's maybe, what, 38, 39 years old by the end of it. It was just insane. Wow. And the timeline literally began from like 10 million BC, because in 1956, in Detective Comics, Batman and Robin and Batwoman, Batgirl, and Ace the Bat-Hound all went back in time to fight dinosaurs and cavemen.
Oh, God bless
like, it was truly a window into madness. You know what I mean? I was like, you're doing it wrong, dude. I'm sorry.
You're enjoying your comics wrong, sir. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's like, what are you doing, dude? How long did this take you?
I don't know. I mean, is there a wrong way to enjoy comics? Maybe that guy has a small circle of friends, and he's got a friend who's got a Flash timeline, another friend with a Superman timeline, and they sit around and talk to each other.
And the guy with the Flash timeline is pissed.
Well, I figured they're all be pissed because, you know, all their timeline work just got crumbled up and thrown away. We got a new 52 out there. None of that stuff matters. It's all in the past. It's gone.
Or he's pissed because he's stuck with the Flash.
Ah, so. I don't know what the healthiest way. I mean, I guess for the way I look at it, I didn't really start reading comics till I was almost done with high school. And that was in the mid-late 90s. So I was right in right before the boom, or I guess right before the bubble burst. And I remember all the different covers, all the changes, like with Batman dying, Superman dying, like the JLA Avenger book, all that kind of stuff. I guess to me, when I came in, everything was such in a state of flux. I mean, Hal Jordan had stopped being Green Lantern, and all this stuff was always changing. For me, I was looking, well, that's how continuity works. It's always changing. There's nothing ever set in stone.
It's always been that way. Yeah. I mean, go pick up a Marvel title from 1979 and read the bullpen bulletins in the back, and you'll see that like Doctor Strange had a mask, and you know, Iron Man had a nose, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that sort of stuff's been continual and ongoing. Like I said, I think it only matters to you when you're at a certain age, you know, as a reader, and then you grab it.
That you like. I think it all comes down to personal taste, as it should. Mm-hmm. You know, people went nuts when Hercules took over the Hulk's book.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a whole other thing with I guess that's another thing that pisses people off is the numbering thing. I mean, is a number truly that important to a book? I mean, I guess the new number one is a flashy thing, but if Hercules takes over the Hulk, or if Jim Lee and Scott Snyder are writing Man of Steel and they're not doing Action Comics, I guess to me, maybe I'm too passive when it comes to things. I don't see the big hullabaloo of them doing Man of Steel 1 or Action Comics number 652. I don't really look at a number when I grab a book. I look at the cover, I see if it's interesting, and I read it that way. I never really think about I never think about how it all ties in. It seems like way too much homework, and I have enough homework for school myself. I don't have time to worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, but just meeting people at comics conventions, people do care about this stuff, and they're really passionate about it. And I think it's because we often forget how much people do look at this as a quote-unquote hobby, something that's always rubbed me the wrong way. Not just as a creator, but as somebody who just reads comics. You know, I don't collect them. I have the most narcissistic comic collection in the world. I collect comics I've written.
That's awesome. Do you like sign them to yourself? Say, to Fred, awesome work, Fred.
Like, when I'm 80, I'm like, you know.
To Fred, hang in there.
Hang in there. It's going to get better.
And I've got the straight razor in my throat, right? And I see that. No, wait. Past me is onto something.
So.
It is something that does matter to a lot of people. But, you know, it is hard to tell how much of this goes beyond the level of, you know, petty bitching to something that, you know, people are taking super seriously.
True. Like, I always like how we – it just seems louder to me now because we have the means to yell at Fred Van Lente because I don't like what he did in the last issue, where in 1967 – I'd have to be pissed off at Fred, write a letter to Marvel, and maybe get put in the back of the book. Where now, I can go to Twitter and call Fred whatever name I want for whatever reason. I would love to have seen the reaction, like, via a Twitter-type thing when they did, like, Crisis on Infinite Earth, or they did, like, Super Spider-Man in the black costume, to see the reaction, if it would just still be as true as it is now. Like, are the fans we have now, you know, a little more apt to bitch and whine about things because we have the means to get to the creators? Or has this been from 1939 when Batman stopped wearing purple gloves? Someone had to piss somebody off that he wasn't wearing his purple gloves anymore. Was it the same back then?
Well, I don't know about back then, but there was this cool magazine called the CBG.
Mm-hmm.
And even back during Crisis on Infinite Earth, people wrote letters to the CBG, and the letter calls of the CBG and the Comics Journal were filled with the same sort of like outrage of the moment. But I think the only thing that's changed is that sort of culture-wide phenomenon of being able to be anonymous on the internet. That's the only aspect of that I think's really changed.
Well, as we talk about in the comic book history of comics, available now from IDW Publishing.
Yeah.
You know, the most of the traditions of comics fandom come from science fiction fandom, and there was a lot of crossover there. And what Gernsback and the guys in Amazing Stories and the various pulp places would do that Julie Schwartz started doing when he became an editor at DC in the 50s was they would actually print everybody's full address, mailing address.
Ooh, that's
nice. Pen pal exchange.
So then what you would have was you know, now you couldn't get away with that, I don't think, for a number of reasons, but, you know, comics fans mysteriously murdered across America.
Yeah, that's, I couldn't imagine that today, giving out people's addresses, how pissed off people would get.
You get Monk on this.
Yeah.
But you know, that's how, so you have these guys like Ian Mabel and a lot of those sort of legendary comics writers. George R. R. Martin, come to think of it, was one of them. He was a inveterate Marvel letter writer in the 60s when he was a kid. You know, that's how these guys could correspond with each other. I mean, that was sort of the crude version of the message boards, you know? But they did, a lot of the Silver Age was inspired by petty fan bitching about bringing back the Atom and Green Lantern and Flash and all those characters. You know, I mean, that's sort of where the whole, I mean, fandom has always been the engine that drives superheroes. Always.
Okay. I guess that's something we have to accept. Because like you said earlier, this isn't like the George R. R. Martin books where he writes them and there's an end. There's going to be Spider-Man forever, and we're going to have to accept the fact that eventually, at a certain point, they kind of have to go and kind of reshuffle things because, I mean, can you run out of Spider-Man stories? I mean, how many times can you write Spider-Man without having to, let's go back and change some stuff, and let's not make him married anymore because we've run out of stories with him being married.
Well, and Martin's a great example because he's somebody who's despised by a good portion of his fan base because I think he takes too long to write his books, you know?
Yeah.
The vitriol spewed at him online is pretty, you know, eyebrow cinching. I mean, he's the guy Damon made the famous comment, you know, George R. R. Martin's not your bitch. You know, the fan let's see if the mute button on my new mic works. I'm totally excited to try this out. So.
Okay. It's like science. So, well, like, I guess I can see how that is, that he has the right to, you know, like, write at his own leisure. If he wants to take 5 years in between books, that's his deal. But then, like I was reading the other day that J.K. Rowling was thinking of going back to her Harry Potter books and do like director's cuts of them, of things that she wanted to put in but she just didn't feel she couldn't flesh out at the time. I mean, it's her property and she can do it that way. To me, that just seems like almost like a petty money grab to go back and add two more chapters to Goblet of Fire because you couldn't get it to work 7 years ago.
George Lucas, what do you think? All right, there goes a further
I mean, that's exactly what it is. And I mean, well, I don't think she'll get the same hatred Lucas does, because her fans, I mean, seem to love her, and she can't do no wrong, but...
Now, Lucas
will hang in there, yeah.
When it's the third or fourth version, I think that's when people were like, you know, I remember being genuinely excited when they came out in the mid-90s, or whenever it was,
when they put them back in theaters?
Yeah, when they put them back in theaters, but now it's like, Jesus, enough already, you know? Mm.
I mean, like, if you want to change them, that's fine, but just keep them for yourself. We don't all need it. We've already seen it. But you can say that, but how many hundreds of millions of dollars does it make every time he puts it out there?
Well, how many hundreds of millions of dollars does he need? You know what I mean? I mean, that, to me, it kind of comes down to, you know, what desire does George Lucas have? What is the need that is making him, you know, does he have a cocaine or gambling problem? You know what I mean? Like, is that what the motivating factor is here? At what point, you know, I don't understand the motivation on the aesthetic level. I don't understand on the business level, unless your goal is just to make a buttload of cash and you have employees to support and annual budgets to make and that kind of thing.
Mm.
But just seems weird.
Well, I've always wondered, someone has to be talking to him about it, but rebooting the Star Wars movie. Because it's time. They've been rebooting every other thing from the 70s and 80s. Why not bring Star Wars back with a new young cast? Get some guys.
The day after George Lucas dies.
I think George Lucas is getting a George R. R. Martin chair there. Yeah, you're right. As soon as he dies, though, they're going to be like, all right.
They'll get some, you know, the cute young girls and the handsome men from the CW, throw them into space. It'll be fine.
Well, you know, the funny thing is he already kind of did that with the...
I
was surprised the Amazing Spider-Man movie was so successful, given the fact that that was such a recent reboot. And I was kind of looking forward to it, and I saw it, and I enjoyed it. But by the same token, I was kind of like,
Yeah, didn't really need it.
I didn't say, you know, I don't know. Feels like, I don't know, empty somehow.
Well, I mean, yeah, look at Man of Steel. I mean, Superman Returns, I mean, wasn't it all that long ago? It's still, I mean, I can still remember the movie, yet they're apparently wiping the slate clean, saying, don't worry, none of that counted. So, I mean, for a movie, how long are you supposed to give it? 15, 20 years before you can reboot it?
you're supposed to give it exactly as long as a producer thinks you or studio thinks you should.
Exactly. I mean,
the second they think they can make money, they'll be there.
My agent told me yesterday they're rebooting Starsky and Hutch, and I was like, really? They're really doing it like Starsky and Hutch? She's a little crazy. The other thing is how many times do I need to see Hamlet? You know what I mean? How many times can the little theater down the block do Our Town and, you know, Pajama Game and keep bringing back the same, the Neil Simon stuff over and over again, you know? People like familiarity.
Yeah, sure. I guess that's an interesting point. Look at the Jane Austen movies and like Emma and those things like that. Those things seem to get remade every 4 or 5 years. I mean, mostly they're like British versions or whatever, but they remake those things every 4 or 5 years. I guess, why not?
Dracula's coming back. Dracula never goes away.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. How many Dracula movies do we actually need?
Well, I mean, it's because there's always going to be a generation for whom that's the first exposure to that work of art or property or franchise, whatever. And, you know, to that generation, that's going to be the one.
Mm.
Like to me, Tom Baker's Doctor Who, because when I was a little kid, that's who Doctor Who was.
Mm.
So I think there's something to that as well.
See, I'm a Paul McGann guy myself. He was the first guy I saw as a doctor, so he's my first image. And
wow.
Then that's the first time I've never even heard of Doctor Who before that TV movie in the mid. I was like 95 or 96. So that was me. And then Chris Eccleston, I guess, he was the next one to play it. And that confused me because I was like, what happened to Paul McGann? Eric Roberts was in that movie. And you can't go wrong with Eric Roberts in a movie, for God's sakes. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. Tom Baker's still the only Doctor Who I've ever seen, I think.
You haven't watched any of the recent ones?
No.
Oh, Phil, come on now. That's good TV.
I can't get into it unless there's papier-mâché aliens.
Well, see, but today's papier-mâché is just bad CGI. And that's what they have. That's the way it is. I mean, come on. Do you watch Sherlock? That's on BBC. That's a good show.
No, I don't watch it. I don't watch anything.
Oh, you people.
I
guess it makes sense.
Listen, Dwayne, we're creators. We're out making.
I was gonna say, yeah. I shouldn't distract you. I want my books to come out on time, so don't worry about it. When you retire from doing comics, you know, like 50 years, you can catch up on all the TV you missed.
Yes.
So, okay, gentlemen, we're going to be wrapping up in a little bit, but this time I'd like to give you the opportunity to pimp your wares, as it were, to let the people listening know about anything you're working on that you have coming out or just came out, and I'll start on my screen left, right. I'll start with James. I know you just had some books come out, horror Halloween themed stuff. So let the people know about that.
Yeah. I just put out some short fiction. Get that like on Amazon or probably the best way is just to go to my site, jamesninnis.com. And then from there, there's links to places you can buy the various stuff. But find me on Twitter and Facebook all through the site.
Definitely. Right now it's really close to Halloween, and I've read all those stories myself. They are perfectly themed for this season. They're very scary, kind of, I don't know, I'd say very horror-ish, very good stuff. Little, not too gory for the kids. I mean, I wouldn't read it to my son, but, you know, you got a teenager.
No,
they'll
don't. Unless the children have your credit card, then they can try it. But
exactly,
I mean,
kids. If you're listening to this and mommy and daddy aren't looking, grab their credit
card. Yeah, try it out. It's got a cool cover.
Uncle James wouldn't steal you wrong. You can trust Uncle James. So, Mr. Van Linty, what are you working on, or what have you just come out?
Well, I guess even with the Halloween theme, a one-shot I'm pretty proud of, Marvel Zombies Halloween, just came out last Wednesday, and that's a fun little one-shot, a sweet,
it was
incredibly gory zombie story.
It was very good.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. We had a lot of fun doing it. And if you're curious, and I guess I just did this because I did one of those Reddit AMA things yesterday. If you're interested, if you go to my website, the entire – I probably posted the entire script on my website, which is the shockingly obtuse URL of fredmanlady.com. So check it out. People often ask me about what my script format is, and there's no set format, but that's the one I use, which is adapted from Steve Gerber's. He's one of my biggest influences in comics, and he posted a unpublished Howard the Duck script on CompuServe in the late 80s. There, I just dated myself.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. It was a Crisis on Infinite Earth / Secret War parody.
Oh, wow.
And so I adapted my script format for what he did, and it's served me well ever since. I'm still doing Archer Armstrong for Valiant, and then in February, I'm the new writer on the newly relaunched G.I. Joe from IDW, which I'm doing with one of my fave artists, a guy by the name of Steve Kirk. We're having a lot of fun with it.
Oh, very cool.
That's kind of breaking news, right?
Not really. It was announced at New York Comic Con, but the interview didn't get published until today.
The inner tubes are slow sometimes.
Well, there's so, you know, there's so much of the there's so much stuff coming out of those big cons. They take 2 weeks to roll out all the stuff, which is fine.
I'm sure. Hey, it was headline news. Hey, G.I. Joe fans probably love that. I mean, I would love to see your G.I. Joe. You got a good sensibility, but I think your style of writing would really work well in that property.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's going to be super violent.
Well, there you go.
It's going to be the Black Hawk Down / Saving Private Ryan version of G.I. Joe.
Now, is this an ongoing or a mini type thing?
No, this is the flagship book. They're relaunching the entire line. Mike Koss will still have his incredible Cobra series, and Chuck Dixon will still be doing Special Ops. It's all exciting stuff. So we'll each have our own, you know, individual teams, but ours will be the adjectiveless main group.
You're not the uncanny G.I. Joe?
Right. This is the Jim Lee. This is the Jim Lee G.I. Joe. Does that make any sense at all? I don't know.
No, that's dating ourselves. I mean, the kids don't know about that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And Mr. Hester, what do you have coming our way?
My main gig right now is I write Guarding the Globe for Skybound / Image, which is sort of the what else is happening in the Invincible Universe book for the Invincible Universe. All the other superheroes who are not currently dying in Invincible are dying in my comic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm also co-writing The Bionic Man at Dynamite with my buddy Aaron Gillespie, and we're in the middle of a Bigfoot saga there for all you fans of the TV show.
Oh, very cool.
And I finished an as-yet unannounced, I guess. Yeah, it's no good for me to talk about unannounced things.
well, you can tease it. It's always good.
I just drew a Batman story for the digital Legends of the Dark Knight book.
Oh, cool.
Josh Jalkov wrote, and it was inked by my buddy Eric Gapster, and that will be in the print edition pretty soon, I think. But that was a lot of fun. I got to draw Batman and one of my favorite Batman villains, Black Mask. Other than that, I'm working on a super secret Image book that I can't talk about yet. But other than that, things are going great.
Very cool. Well, usually I would say for the last month or so I was talking about my Kickstarter in this part, but my Kickstarter finally finished, Midnight Tiger, and it was successfully funded. So thank you to everybody.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thanks to everybody who donated. It should be coming out, I think, in the next month or so, issue one. I'm already working on issue two. Yay. But since I have nothing, my friend Joe Caramagna has his Kickstarter that just started. It's called The Further Travels of Wyatt Earp. It's a Western. It's following Wyatt Earp. Basically, if you've seen the Tombstone movies, that kind of stuff, kind of what happens after that. So, which is cool. Joe's a great writer. He's been on the show a bunch. He was going to be here tonight, but he's busy lettering books for Marvel or something. I don't know. He's big league.
And, and that book is drawn by Scott Koblish, who's immensely talented. Who's a guy I work with a lot. And Scott and Joe both great. I supported that Kickstarter, and you should.
Exactly. I already gave my money. Some people out there. It's a great book. Give a few shekels. All a couple dollars, everything helps. Every dollar helps. So, okay. That's all I have for you guys. I really appreciate your time today, guys. Thanks for being on.
Thank you
for having us.
No worries. Nobody needs a potty break or anything. We're all good to go. I don't want to have to turn the podcast around.
No, I'd like you to hear it when I actually do any one. So.
Well, that could be a whole other show, you know, peeing with Philip Fester, you know?
I'm going to be doing a potty break for the entire hour.
Wow.
You can find a new little niche for the podcast.
You know, there's probably a podcast like that out there. It's the internet. I'm sure there's someone who has that show.